Hey everyone, it's Daisha. This episode includes my conversation with pianist and composer Marc-André Hamelin. He was here in Seattle recently to perform a concert at the Meany Center for the Performing Arts, which is a place that brings in all kinds of cool acts to town. And so I nabbed Marc for an interview while he was here. We talk about something in this episode that I think is kind of a thing for every genre of music, and that is music discovery. Not like discovering by algorithm or robot or whatever, but like going to a music store and finding new things on your own. As it turns out, Marc is a pretty big time collector. He owns like crates of records and he loves to go hunting for them. So in this episode, we talk about how to discover classical music that's new to you, where to get started, pro tips, a few of his favorite gems that he's found in doing this. And this is something that I love to do, but I haven't really known where to start with classical music. So if you too are an aspiring classical music collector geek type, this episode is for you. Just a quick reminder, don't forget to subscribe to, rate, and review Classical Classroom wherever you listen to us. It's how we know you care. And now, a word from our sponsor. Are you new to classical music or know someone who is? Why, yes. Maestro Classics' recording of Peter and the Wolf is the best way to introduce classical music. Why choose Maestro Classics' Peter and the Wolf? Well, this production has the only complete instrumental recording performed by the London Phil, a version on Russian folk instruments, which you're hearing right now, a biography on the composer, music lessons with the conductor, a 24-page activity book, and it's the number one selling Peter and the Wolf CD on Amazon. Listen to it at maestroclassics.com and save 17% on your order when you use the code CLASSROOM. All right, and now on with the show. I'm going to try that one more time, and this time with smizing. You know, smiling with your eyes. Can you feel it? Okay. There's a rumor going around that classical music can be hoity-toity. But here in the classical classroom, we beg to differ.
Beethoven 5.
The idea that classical music is a zone where we have to feel restricted or we have to act in a certain way, you know, that's not going to be helpful going forward.
Isaiah is shaking with excitement.
Oh, here. I mean, there's just so many great parts of the opera.
He asked me to play his favorite spot in the first movement of the Brahms. And then he said, I started using those licks in my guitar solos.
How to be classical music rock stars, because there's not enough of that in this business.
Occasionally, I would plug in the mandolin to my distortion pedals.
I don't change my voice.
And talking to classical music voice.
I'm playing classical music now. I mean, it's the same 12 notes. That's what's so cool about it.
I'm Daisha Clay, a classical music newbie, and I'm trying to learn all I can about the music. Come learn with me and the classical music experts I invite into the Classical Classroom. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Classical Classroom. I'm Daisha Clay, and here with me in the studio today is world-renowned pianist and composer Marc-André Hamelin. Today, Marc is going to teach me about musical curiosity and discovery. Marc, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
So, before we get started, I want to know a little bit about your story. So, speaking of discovery, when did you first discover classical music?
I was 5, basically. Well, one could actually argue it was even before that, because I started lessons when I was 5, but because my dad was actually a very good amateur pianist, I mean, he played every day, you know, so I could listen to him, you know, from even earlier than that. And apparently, every time I played, I was really fascinated and go to the piano and listen to him. So after a while, when he saw that I was really, really interested and tried to do stuff at the keyboard, maybe improvising or whatever, you know, he asked me if I wanted lessons, and I said yes. So it was around my 5th birthday that I started. It felt very natural from the very start and never stopped. There was never anything impeding my progress because my parents were always very supportive.
Yeah.
So that's basically how it started. You know, it was always a very positive feeling around it all.
Was there any other kind of music going on in your house besides?
Not at that time, no. My sister actually started piano lessons at the same time and quit after 3 years because I was really the one who was developing the fastest. And for her, it was just one frustration after another.
No, no.
but she does still very, very much like to listen to classical music. And she took up the flute and the viola later as well. But the thing is, when we got to be teenagers, when at the height of the disco craze, you know, she started listening to that, and I thought disco was the Antichrist.
I think a lot of people thought that the end was nigh.
Now I think it's terribly amusing, you know, but I thought she'd sold her soul to the devil or something like that. You know, she went to the other camp, you know, and I couldn't stand it. What a dumbass I was.
Because you came to love the disco.
Well, yes, much later. I mean,
really?
It's a period, you know. It's a style, you know, that we had to go through, you know, and I mean, some of these things are really great classics by now.
It did give us amazing fashion and Saturday Night Fever.
It's hard to think of a musical trend, I think, that didn't have some kind of a fashion trend to go with it.
That's very true. Is that true for classical music? I've never really thought about that.
No.
Like back in the day when Mozart was playing, were people looking at what he was wearing and going, oh, wow, where'd he get those pantaloons from?
Well, you know, for us men, at least, it's been, for most of the time, rather boring, you know, a three-piece suit. But a lot of us are trying to transcend that because, well, you know, speaking for myself, a full tux or whatever, you know, or full, even just a suit sometimes is very, very, very hot. And there's many of my colleagues who have even gone to designers to help them get something that's light, that looks good, but is very, very light. Because we, in the worst circumstances, we can sweat our body weight off, you know.
That's, yeah, I bet, like, in an evening of performance, you're wearing, like, all of those layers of clothing, none of which are moisture wicking, I'm going to bet.
Yeah.
And
so, one extreme example.
Spotlight.
One extreme example. I mean, I was playing in the church in the summer, and it would have already been stifling, but there were also TV lights.
Oh my God.
And
That sounds terrible.
When I get really hot like that, it's very, very difficult to concentrate. It seems like my brain is just draining, you know, as I'm playing. Anyway,
totally.
Enough of that.
Yeah. No, it's interesting. That's something I've never thought about before. So, but we're going to talk about discovering rare and hidden gems. And I kind of want to get eventually into telling listeners how they too can do that. But first, I kind of want to set up, you know, the fact that you are talking about musical discovery from both sides of the musical equation. You're a musician and a composer.
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking about, I'm assuming, finding music that feeds you as a composer, finding music that feeds you as a musician.
Yes, but I primarily think about the audience. I mean, I have to do it for myself. I have to have personal fulfillment.
Yeah.
But that means nothing if you go on a stage. I mean, you go on a stage really to share. That's what I do. I mean, I that's my main thrust, my main reason for doing this.
So you like discovering so you can share with others.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's an incredible privilege to go out there and say, listen, how beautiful this is or how challenging this is, or you didn't know this before, but I have the privilege of exposing it to you.
Yeah.
And see what you think. You may or may not like it, but at least there are people out there who really make an effort, you know, but by and large, I think the recital situation is a little stale. I mean, especially a lot of young people rely on the same safe set of constantly heard repertoire, especially when you get to very virtuosic things. I mean, I'm thinking especially of something like the Stravinsky Three Movements from Petrushka, you know, which every young pianist now eats for breakfast. Some of these pieces are just heard over and over and over and over, and it's not about the music anymore. It's about what this pianist can do with it, you know. And this might be a kind of an idealistic thing, but when I go on stage, I want people to forget that I'm there. I want them to experience the music in its purest form. Directly. Of course, that's not realistic because when people go to recitals and if they have free seating, they'll always want to sit where you can see the hands the best, you know. And I understand that. I mean, there is some a certain attraction to that.
Is that so they can be sure that you're actually playing?
No, they. I never heard that one before. But I think it just takes away a little bit from the real thrust of the experience, which is the music itself.
That's an interesting thing, though, because I've had the beginnings of this conversation with a couple of different people where we're talking about in the intro to the show, we have a quote from a bunch of different people. And one of them is a guy who's saying that he thinks that classical music needs more rock stars. And it's so strange that in classical music, composers are the stars, but the people who are up there like you, you're playing this music, you've been playing it since you were 5 years old. So many amazing musicians in the classical world, like, they don't, it's not the same as like in pop music, you know,
yeah,
or in rock music, where it's because you're going to see the performers.
If you go to hear Taylor Swift or Celine Dion,
yeah,
or whatever,
I mean,
you're never going to hear about who actually wrote the music.
Right. And usually it was Sia, who, she writes all of the pop music, apparently.
Yeah. It's always the same little nucleus of people, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. And they all write the songs, and no one cares who wrote
it. That's right.
And you like to go one step further and think of yourself as more of a conduit than a...
Exactly. That's a channeler, practically like a medium, I guess. Well, although that's a little bit pretentious.
I like that, though.
But I don't want to be pretentious. I mean, I just want to... it's good, as I said, to have the privilege of transmitting these things to people, mm-hmm, you know, but I don't want the attention on me, however unrealistic that may be.
That's a real tightrope to walk, too, when you're the dude on stage in front of thousands of people. Because you're up there. People are there to see you. But I kind of like that idea that, like, when you're up there playing, you're not thinking, they like me, they really like me. You're thinking about the music, you know, you're thinking about the experience that you're giving them. And you're also thinking about this music that maybe they haven't heard.
Mm-hmm.
And getting to present that to the audience, which is really cool.
Yeah, and it's not only about the lesser known repertoire; it's also about the repertoire they actually know. And here, the challenge is to present it, to illuminate it in a different way, so they can come away with maybe a fresher look on it, or a different look on it.
How do you go about digging up new things? How do you go about finding stuff?
Well, there's several ways. I mean, first of all, I've been a compulsive collector of printed music, of sheet music, ever since I was a teenager. Somehow, I mean, I really do have the collecting bug. It's something that I can't explain. And I realized rather quickly, and then over the ensuing years, even more and more, that the piano literature, that field is just a horn plenty.
Mm.
And there's always something to be discovered, because I think there's like an incalculable number of composers who've written for the piano.
Mm-hmm.
Admittedly, a lot of it, especially the music of the 19th century, you know, is, a lot of it is passé. A lot of it is just not very good to begin with.
Mm.
And, fashions come and go, but there are some pieces of music which, I mean, it would be difficult to think that they could come back into fashion, because they're totally. I mean, that's something that's really extraordinarily difficult to define.
And just to be clear, what you're talking about, I think, is like certain trends in music that are born out of a particular time. Like, one thing that springs to mind is the little ornamentation that you hear in Baroque music. When you hear that, you're like, oh, that's probably Baroque music.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
But I'm really referring to, for example, pieces that were clearly written for salon music purposes, you know, just for written for a small group of people, or just for people to play by themselves at home.
Okay.
And that are not really designed for the concert experience.
Yeah.
That's really what I mean, mostly.
Okay.
So a lot of these things, although collectors will seek them out sometimes, you know, I don't think really are suited for concert performance any longer.
Mm-hmm.
Which doesn't mean that you can't enjoy them, you know, yourself, you know, playing at home, you know, but that's a different thing. I'm really talking about the music that one presents on stage.
So, but you're looking for pieces that transcend a time and
Exactly. Pieces that really, I guess the word I'm coming up with is longevity.
Yeah.
I mean, there's parallels in literature, of course. Some literature is really of its time and doesn't really survive well. Well, other masterpieces are just always relevant.
Okay, so I'm taking a little sidebar from my interview with Marc-André Hamelin to tell you guys about our new website. It's at classicalclassroomshow.com, and it's got some new features on it that you should check out if you haven't done so already. There are things like all of our previous episodes, ways to connect with us, free downloadable lesson plans and study guides for teachers, boom, boom, boom. There's also a little button that says Tip Jar, where you can now leave us a one-time or recurring gift. It can be any level. It can be a buck. It can be 500 bucks. Whatever numbers you can make, you can donate that. If you'd like to support the work that we do on the podcast with your dollars, that's available to you now. And we will give you stuff for your contribution. So you should check that out. Anyway, if you want a website that is as cool as ours, you should contact our buddies at New Y. They made the website for us, and they can make you a great one too. They can also help you promote it and to promote your business digitally. For more information about New Y, go to classicalclassroomshow.com/NW. That's N as in new and W as in Y. All right, now back to my convo with Marc-André Hamelin. When I was thinking about our conversation today, the thing that I'm most familiar with looking for are books, like finding new books and interesting things. I love reading, always have. But I can find myself in Portland. There's Powell's City of Books, which is, I think, the largest
bookstore in the world.
I think at least in the States.
Yeah.
I barely make it out of the first room, usually, within the first hour, because I'm so overwhelmed with how much there is. And I'm just like, what if I miss something good? So how do you sort of streamline a search for new music? Where do you start? What do you do when you're like, all right, I'm going digging for something good, something new? Like,
well, funnily enough, I don't do it as compulsively as I could. Uh-huh. I get things here and there.
Yeah.
I was saying earlier that I've been collecting sheet music since I was a teenager. Uh-huh. I mean, I have now about 100 crates of it.
Whoa.
Yeah. It's the collection has gotten to be a little bit like an albatross, you know, because when it comes time to move it, and it's not fun.
Yeah.
I can't do it anymore. And at my age, I have to have help. You know, I used to do it myself. But even if I just spent time reading, sight reading what I have, mm-hmm. you know, I would have material for 20 lifetimes.
Yeah.
Very, very occasionally, I'll find myself in a library and discover things. But that's really not how I find things. I mean, I do buy recordings,
mm-hmm.
although if I really want to find out about something, mm-hmm. I go to the score itself.
Okay.
I can get a certain amount by just looking at it and hearing it internally. I don't necessarily need a piano. But if it's too complicated or if it would be difficult to get an idea of it just by reading it, you know, I will listen to a recording.
Let's talk specifically about a few things that you have dug up in your searches that are unearthed and that you might recommend that people check out.
I have a specific example where I found a piece that nobody knows. This composer wasn't published in the West.
Mm-hmm.
He was Russian. Mm-hmm. His name was Leonid Sabaneyev. He was a composer and also a critic. He was a friend of Scriabin, actually. He wrote a book about his reminiscences of Scriabin, the man, mm-hmm. and the composer. And a few years ago, I had the opportunity to have almost his complete works, you know, in PDF form. I mean, it's so rare that I haven't found one actual piece of sheet music yet of this composer.
Wow.
And I read a few of them, you know, and I came across this little prelude. It's a two-page piece. And it is an absolutely extraordinarily wonderful miniature. It's very, very quiet. It's very slow, and it's full of luminosity. And the harmonic world in there is just really, really fascinating.
And that is so interesting, like, that this, you can't find the music anywhere. It's no. A composer you've literally never heard of.
Right now, I think some of his music has found its way onto the IMSLP service. And for people who don't know, that's it's a gigantic library of copyright-free music.
Oh, okay.
Music that's in the public domain.
That's good to know.
And that is the main source right now for to get anything rare.
Oh, just a tangent for a second, since you were talking about that service. I mean, so far we've been talking about sort of organic and analog ways of discovering music, but obviously there are things like Spotify and Pandora and all of the robots out there that use algorithms to try to find music that's like whatever it is that you've gone to listen to. Do you ever use any of those?
No, I use my brain.
Weird.
Yes, unusual and not of its time, I know, but it's...
It sounds like discovering music for you is just, it's a hobby. It's a knee-jerk reaction. It's part of what you do, and it's something that you find really fun to do, which I think is really cool. Give us another gem that you've found that you think listeners might enjoy.
Some years ago... a friend of mine attracted my attention to a set of six songs by the French singer-songwriter Charles Trenet, who's not very well known here, but he's very well known in France. And these songs were arranged by the great pianist Alexis Weissenberg. Even though he was a classical pianist, he had a very, very strong sort of pop streak about him. He wrote at least two musicals that I know of. And most of his compositions were actually in the popular vein, and he did a lot of arrangements. And these were on a 45 RPM issued sometime, I think, around 1956. And I thought the arrangements were really, really terrific. And since there was no score at the time, I wrote them down from the record, which was not easy,
of course. You transcribed them from the record?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And then I recorded them on the Hyperion label. It's on a CD called In a State of Jazz. And finally, these arrangements are going to be published next month, and I'm very, very happy about that.
Cool.
I'll be playing them, actually, as part of a recital in Carnegie Hall on November 15th.
Wow.
Which is, it's fantastic that they let me do that, you know, because Carnegie Hall, for all their greatness, tend to be a little cautious about programming. But they over the years, they've let me do sort of bolder and bolder things. You know, I couldn't be happier about that.
So what's bold about this particular piece? Is it just that it isn't
known? Well, it's just
that
nobody knows about them.
So you're like, okay, I'm going to play this piece. And the Carnegie Hall people said, I don't know about that. We've never heard of that
before. Well, you know, you have to realize that there's a large portion of the public who, going to concerts is very expensive.
Oh, right.
So they want to be as sure as possible that they're going to get something out of it.
That's interesting.
But if the unknown, however accessible it might be, it might end up being, is still something to be afraid of for certain people.
You know, I never
And you
really
have to respect that.
That.
You have to respect that.
I never really thought about that in the classical music world. So often, you know, what's on a program for a particular night is all like, I've heard all of that. It doesn't sound like anything new. There are so many living composers making really cool new music, like yourself, and we're not getting to hear any of that. And I've thought, well, you know, it's probably about money, it's probably about this and that, but it never occurred to me that it could be because people like the comfort zone of the known.
Mm-hmm. But that's only a portion of the population, because there are other people who are who come to concerts clearly to be, well, challenged maybe, but also to discover.
Yeah. That's what the great thing, because I mean, when you go to see a band, when you go to see a rock band or something like that, typically they're playing songs that you know and you like singing along to it. But what's great?
Yeah, you want to hear live what's on the record,
right? Yeah. But what's great is like when they play a new song you've never heard before, or they play a song in a different way. They do like a different arrangement of it or something like that. That's what makes a live show so cool. Well, so my last question to you is, can you give a little bit of advice to the listeners for how they can go and find rare, hidden stuff in the world of classical music that they too might enjoy?
Up to a point, reviews, I think, are very, very useful. I mean, when you want to find out about a hotel or a bed and breakfast or whatever, you read reviews. Mm. You know, of course, you can apply your own personal filters to these reviews, but at least it gives you an idea of whether you might like it or not.
Yeah, that's
so experiment. It's the field of wine, for example, it can be very intimidating, just as intimidating as classical music, you know, because, I mean, you know, wine experts talk in vocabulary that it makes you think, I mean, I'll never elevate myself to that level of sophistication and sensitivity.
Yeah.
But nobody should tell you what to like.
Mm-hmm.
So just go there, experiment for yourself, and the recorded music is there. And, you know, feel free to sample from it.
So start with reviews.
Yes.
Trust your gut.
Oh, yeah.
And then just listen.
Yeah. And with time, you will develop an ability to compare.
Mm-hmm.
Say, oh, I like this more than that. Oh, let me find out more of that.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sure that on the internet, there are groups that help you point out, you know, if you like this, try that.
Yeah.
You know? So the tools are there, especially in this age of heightened and accessible information on the internet. I think the field is more exciting than ever.
Yeah. So if you like Beethoven, you may like blah, blah, and blah, and like go look for that.
Absolutely.
Like, use a particular composer that you know you like or a particular piece and use that as a jumping off point to get going.
Yeah.
Okay. This is all really solid advice. I shall take it and use it for myself. Marc-André Hamelin, thank you so much for coming in to talk to me today. This was really interesting, and I know you have a very busy schedule, so I really appreciate it.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Okay, everyone, that does it for this episode of Classical Classroom. For more Classroom, go to classicalclassroomshow.com, where you can find all of the ways to connect with us that you could ever want, and you can do so many other things, such as downloading free lesson plans and leaving us a tip. As always, you can email us at classicalclassroomshow@gmail.com. Don't forget to subscribe to, rate, and review us on the iTunes or wherever you listen. Thanks today to the home of Classical Classroom, King FM in Seattle, where we hang our hats on a tiny little hat rack. Thanks to our birthplace, Houston Public Media. Thanks to the official lightsaber supply company of Classical Classroom, Green, Red, and Blue Lightsabers. Please note that they do not accept droids as payment. Thanks to Marc-André Hamelin for being on the show. By the way, he's touring, and you should go to his website and find out the details if you'd like to see if he's coming to your town. Thanks to me for saying words, but most of all, thanks to you for listening. We'll catch you next time.